As this is a show dedicated to the correction of misinformation in popular culture, sharing the tools for telling what's real from what's not, it's important that we get things right. But we don't, always. And so today, we've got another episode for you dedicated to the correction of errors in past episodes. And some of them are surprising. That's up next on Skeptoid. Head on over to skeptoid.com/store and explore the Skeptoid store where curiosity meets cool. We have books, socks, shirts, hoodies, and more. Check out our slick new Bigfoot design, where the mystery of this legendary cryptid never looked so good. And while you're here, don't forget to grab a Skeptoid USB drive, your portal to all episodes and all our movies, now including the UFO movie They Don't Want You to See. That's not all we have planned. We have a lineup of way more cool stuff coming soon. So head on over, skeptoid.com/store, and snag your swag. This episode is sponsored in part by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. You're listening to Skeptoid. I'm Brian Dunning from Skeptoid.com. A collection of corrections. Welcome to another corrections episode of the Skeptoid podcast. Yes, I do occasionally get things wrong. So far, it's never been anything big that impacted the overall conclusion. But almost every week, there's some little detail that made it past my non-existent fact-checking staff. And whenever it happens, it's important to set the record straight. Doubling down on errors does nobody any good. But admitting them and fixing them sets an example we all want to follow. As always, I want to advise new listeners that this is not a regular episode, but the corrections we're going to discuss reference a lot of good ones, and maybe you'll hear one that you want to check out next, and hear the original error in all its glory. So without further ado, let's get started. We'll begin with the recent episode number 780, on the fad of adding CBD to every product in the known galaxy for no imaginable reason. In the show, I pointed out that Epidiolex, a prescription epilepsy drug in which CBD is the active ingredient, was listed as a Schedule 5 drug in 2018. Listener Skyler wrote in and said, in part,
"As of April 2020, the drug Epidiolex, which was the substance listed as controlled, was removed from Schedule 5.
And provided a link to the drug maker's press release. The correction has been noted on the transcript. So what does this mean? Basically, it means that Epidiolex, and thus CBD, is not considered a controlled substance. This is appropriate because there was very little enforcement against CBD products during the period in which it was scheduled. And now companies are free, according to federal law anyway, to continue selling CBD in whatever products consumers are clamoring to buy it in. Knock yourselves out, folks. A few episodes before that was a very popular one, number 773, in which I nominated my top 10 pro-science fictional characters. Among these was the famous Dr. Frankenstein, the hero of Mary Shelley's groundbreaking 1818 novel. However, I fell into what is apparently a common trap. Listener Craig wrote in,
"You included Dr. Frankenstein, yet there is no Dr. Frankenstein in Mary Shelley's book. That honorific was tacked on by later works which were derivative of a stage play, which was in turn loosely derived from the book. Victor Frankenstein was a college student of roughly 22 years old when he brought the creature to life. I'm sure that age seemed very adult to Shelley when she was 17.
First of all, wow, Mary Shelley was only 17 when she wrote it? I had to look that one up, and found a correction to throw back at Craig. She was 18, born in August 1797, and she wrote the first version of the book beginning in June of 1816. Still, pretty impressive to write one of literature's most famous works at that age. And sure enough, Victor Frankenstein was never a doctor. In fact, he never completed his college studies at all. He left school when his monster killed its first victim, and spent the rest of his short days in pursuit of it. Episode number 761 was about Havana Syndrome, a name for an alleged group of widely diverse and unrelated symptoms reported to be suffered by certain U.S. diplomats overseas, and now some inside the United States as well. Many have been haphazardly assigning the blame for this on various fantastical and hypothetical weapons that employ some form of radio beams. During the discussion of such hypothetical devices, I said that electromagnetic radiation follows the inverse cube law. The strength of the signal drops off by the inverse of the cube root of the distance away. Apparently, this caused grievous emotional harm to listener Juan, a professor of physics and astronomy.
My astrophysics heart sank about 8 minutes into the podcast when you say EM radiation follows the inverse cube law of intensity. Intensity drops off as the inverse square of distance, still enough to reduce the intensity quickly, although not as quickly as inverse cube would.
Of course he's right, and inverse square is what I'd always thought, so I set about to learn how the mix-up happened. Well, I blame my own confusion, sorting through a very lively discussion we had about this one on the Skeptoid Research mailing list, which included some talk about the field strength around magnetic dipoles. And in their case, it is indeed the inverse cube law that applies, not the inverse square law. So the error was absolutely mine, and I will try harder to organize flurries of emails in the future. Episode number 337 was about the Bermuda Triangle, a named area of the ocean where statistics show us for a certainty that absolutely nothing unusual happens. While discussing its folkloric origins, I happened to mention that the first time the term Bermuda Triangle is known to have been used in print was a 1964 short story. Listener Francis, a novelist, wrote in,
"The very first use of the term Bermuda Triangle seems to be in an article in the Eunice News from January 29, 1932, page 5. This article talks about the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution program of investigations in the deep waters of the western North Atlantic. There were also many commercial triangle trips and cruises in the 1930s in this part of the ocean, Bermuda, Nassau, etc., which may have led to this name. The first time the term Bermuda Triangle was used in the today's meaning might be in the Morning Herald, Hagerstown, Maryland, January 12, 1946, page 23. There, a baseball trainer is talking about a player who didn't show up, saying, maybe he's in the Bermuda Triangle."
If the baseball trainer was speaking about it so casually, that's a pretty good indicator that the term was already in general use. And if it was, then it's entirely probable that someone else will turn up some even earlier print references. I've updated my episode's transcript to note that my original statement of fact was actually a statement of error. Are you ready to take your Skeptoid experience to the next level? Head on over to skeptoid.com/gopremium to become a proud member and unlock a world of exclusive benefits. Picture this: ad-free listening and extended versions of every new episode, diving deep into the mysteries and real truth without interruption. Take this opportunity to elevate your journey and join the Skeptoid community today. Skeptoid.com/gopremium. Episode number 756 looked into the origins of the astonishing tale of the sea about the SS Orang Maidan, a ship said to have been found with all its crew horribly murdered under bizarre circumstances. Following all the story's threads back into time, it became clear that it was all the invention of one guy who cheerfully sent his dispatches about the gruesome tale from his home in Trieste, Italy. Or did he? Listener Anne Marie had this to say.
Super specific and trivial possible correction. Trieste was not really part of Italy at the time discussed in the episode. Depending on the exact date being used, you're obviously talking about a very tumultuous time in history. I only know anything about this from being part Slovenian and having visited Trieste as a kid.
True. Today's Trieste is indeed part of Italy now, but prior to 1975, its history has been all over the place. Sometimes it was part of Italy, and other times it wasn't. And I won't remotely try to summarize it here. Even for the dates it was mentioned in the Skeptoid episode, which spanned from before World War II to after it, sometimes it was, and sometimes it wasn't. It's a fascinating little reminder that you really can't take anything for granted when you're writing about historical events. Episode number 748 was about all the various theories for what caused the USS Maine to explode in Havana Harbor in 1898, thus triggering the Spanish-American War. In my description of the great battleship, I mentioned that it was dazzle-painted, a type of naval camouflage often associated with the dreadnoughts of World War I. Listener Bill was among those who wrote in, and he said,
"You might want to check on the dazzle camouflage paint remark, though. Dazzle camouflage was first used in 1916 by the Brits, who kept losing ships to the U-boats. Since this was pre-radar days, visual sightings were all the Germans had to go on. Admiralty went to the artists of the time and asked them what would be the most effective. Cubism was the going thing, so the artists came up with a cubist solution. Americans picked up the dazzle paint schemes in 1917, much to the disgust of salty old blue water admirals. All I can say is, it's lucky they didn't go to Andy Warhol."
When people first started writing in with this correction, it kind of blew my mind because I had a picture on my desk of the Maine and it was clearly painted in dazzle. Retrieving it for another look, I was gobsmacked to discover my error. In that particular photo of it at anchor in Havana, a large geometric shadow was cast across part of its hull, and another part was shadowed from an overhanging gun turret. My brain filled in the rest. I wrote that whole episode with the Maine in my head as a dazzle camouflaged ship, even looking right past all the other photos in which it's clearly not in dazzle, dismissing them because, of course, ships would get painted and repainted all the time. It was another lesson in not taking anything for granted, even things you're looking right at with your own two eyes. Episode number 307 was about the so-called Well to Hell, a mythical hole drilled by some scientists in Siberia that made it all the way down to hell and released the screams of the damned. In the episode, I repeated what most accounts say, that the audio recording was sent in and played by radio host Art Bell on the Coast to Coast AM show in 2002. Listener Don wrote in and said,
"This article states that the Art Bell show played the referenced clip in the year 2002, but I recorded that clip from the Art Bell show in 1998 from the radio. The date tag is on my file. It matches what you quoted too, so that is correct, just the year is way off. Maybe it was a rerun in 2002.
Although I couldn't find any authoritative source for original broadcasts and their dates for 1998 episodes of Coast to Coast, Don did send me his real audio file, and I did check out the date stamps. Now, I know those can be faked, but why? It's much more likely that 2002 was simply a rebroadcast, and most other writers simply didn't dig any farther than I did. So I'm going to strike my gavel and assert that the Well to Hell was originally broadcast in 1998. And with that, another round of corrections is duly filed, the transcripts updated, and all is made well with the world. Until next time, always do your best, and when you stumble, pick yourself right back up. A great big Skeptoid shout-out to premium supporters Harold A. Geller, Andrew Burgess, Melanie Keel, and Derek B. Are you an educator? Have you seen our Teacher's Toolkit? It's a way to share all the best Skeptoid episodes with your classroom in a secure, organized, and controlled way. Come and check out our 3-minute video explainer to see how it works at skeptoid.com/teachers. And while you're here, pick up an autographed Skeptoid book or a t-shirt in our online store. We've got all the styles, sizes, and colors at skeptoid.com/store. You're listening to Skeptoid, a listener-supported program. I'm Brian Dunning from skeptoid.com.